RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is CX of M Radio, the voice of customer experience professionals.
UX podcast. This is your host, Darren Hood. Thanks everyone for taking the time to tune in on today. And as always, a very special welcome to those of you that are tuning in to the podcast for the very first time. We are in the midst of a three-part session, a really energetic session that I had with the Ivory family, with Spencer Ivory and with his daughter, Ayana. This is going to be part two of that three-part series. So without further ado, let's go ahead and dive back in and pick up where we left off last time, backing up a couple minutes, shall we? All right, enjoy. I heard somebody say that early in my career, UX is the voice of reason. And so we have to embrace that, beat back the order taker mindset, which I think a lot of people today are don't know that we're not order takers. And then when you get order, when you become an order taker, you like signing your own death warrant from a business perspective. It looks like you're about to say something there, Spencer.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, my daughter brings up a good point about the fact of the scope creep, but the, you know, the beat back on that is if you just do agile, right? Agile just cuts all that stuff down because now you have your epic. Your epic says, this is how big the sky is. And then you break stuff down the stories. You go, this is the story we're working on. I'm sorry. So I think the thing is there are effective tools to keep all that scope creep craziness in line because, you know, for the longest time, I don't know where you got involved or got involved with agile development. I hated it because UX just did not fit. Yeah. Just couldn't. I couldn't cram waterfall, all that stuff we did in waterfall. And you know, all the stuff that goes on in waterfall into a 2 week sprint. But do you know, over the last, I want to say the last 10 years, I had to embrace it. I learned the lean UX, but do you know the value? If agile is done correctly, cause you know, I went back to school, got that skin on the wall. And the thing that I learned about agile design and development is the fact is that you divide and conquer and you chunk things up. Because from that epic, that big picture, because the marketing manager comes and goes, well, I want this, I want that. And you go, okay, fine. Let's sit down and write the story for this thing. And you go, ain't going to happen, right? Because development is going to say, well, you know, we got a 2 week sprint. What do you want? You got 2 weeks. What do you want? So now you got these stories, right?
Yep.
So now everything chunkified for you and you can control scope creep because you now have, as you say, the charter on the wall, which is the epic, and it says the user is going to do blah 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 blah, right? You know, what is it outtake? Well, he wants to do this, and this is his goal, and this is what that story. So you now have these little bite-sized pieces that you can just sort of like keep them on pace and on par. So that's, to me, the way you deal with the analogous scope creep. Well, the project manager says, I interviewed you for this, and this is what we want you to do. And he said, okay, let's okay, you do agile development? Great. I always say, you do great agile development? Yeah. And then now we go, I said, okay, here's your epic. And I lay it all out. Is that to cover everything? Yeah, that covers everything. Said, now let's break this up into stories, bite-sized pieces. Mm-hmm. That's then fantastic. They can't do that to you anymore. They can't do that to you. And you know, I'm telling you, there it works. It is. Yes. It's like,
yeah.
It's like a silver stake you put in Dracula's heart, right? You go to his crib and you go, bang, dude, you're dead because I got this stake, and you are now history. And you pound that sucker in, and they just kind of go, oh, you got me boxed in. I can't do anything. I said, no. If you really want to go back, now you got to go back and do all this other stuff. And then because you put the ownership back on them.
Yes.
Because
yes.
You always come in. You always kind of have to answer all dancing around, answering all these questions. And they're like, well, you sound like you really don't want to do the work. I do want to do the work, but you just keep changing. You're moving the goalposts on me again, right? You know, mm-hmm. the ball's here and you move the goalposts. So I think the thing is, if you do the agile approach, you lock them out. You lock them out.
That's fantastic. Yes, that's perfect. That's perfect. Next question or next topic. Spencer mentioned it was a phrase. You were describing something, and I'm sure you're going to be able to recall exactly what this was. And the phrase you said was doing the right thing. And I think you talked about it a little bit when you were talking about consulting, but I want to revisit that to see if there's anything that we didn't cover. Because I think it's a great concept for people to, a mantra in a sense, that people could embrace. What does it mean to do the right thing? And what does the UX professional get out of doing the right thing?
Oh, that's a real big, doing the right thing is, you know, it's part of what, you know, my daughter asked about this, the scope creep. And it is just assessing. And I think you have to bring the tools to it. You just can't just go, okay, arbitrarily say, okay, this is that. You know, you say, okay, where do you want to play? How do you want to win? You know, what is the overall cost of the leadership? The differentiation? Are we stuck in the middle? And what is the focus? So you get all this stuff happening at the same time, revolving. But I think to answer that question, it's more about just we think of when we look at a solution space, we say, okay, I have an idea how to solve, but you have to come through experience. It's sort of like what my father and I, because I grew up on a farm. So I'm bouncing around a little bit, but I think I'll come back and it'll make sense. You plant your seed in the ground and you hope that Mother Nature will work with you and you get your crop out of the ground. But oftentimes Mother Nature's fickle. You get more rain than you get dry spells. Like right now, the earth is being scorched because there's not enough water. I mean, it's just so overly hot. I mean, what's going on in the UK? People are like, the roads are buckling. They're not designed to handle that. I think when we're in a design space, you have to have the ability to reach into your toolkit to pull out the right tool and apply it to the problem that you're trying to solve. If you're not well-versed in that arena, or if you don't have that wherewithal to do that, then it doesn't make you bad or it's a shortcoming on your behalf. But what you have to do is to be learning it enough to go and study and get the right answer. Oftentimes, mm-hmm. you don't have the right answer, right? But then you have to be smart enough to say, okay, you know, I'll get back to you tomorrow morning. Well, you know, your evening is going to be, I'm going to research that. You know, I'm going to figure that out, right? I'm going to ask the right people. I'm going to send out an email. I think the thing is using all your available resources. It's like when you go to grad school and, you know, you got that damn paper due in the morning. And, man, you're like laboring until like 5 o'clock in the morning. You don't even sleep. There are times when I didn't even sleep when I was doing stuff. But I think the thing is, it's because I wanted to win. I really wanted to show up and show up as an individual. And to show up as an individual, I had to be learned enough to do the extra work. I don't think you, when you get a job, that you stop learning. I think when you're in that environment, and especially in the corporate world, you have to understand, where is the tipping point for you to win? Who are those people that you need to engage with? What are the things that that organization do and they don't do well? So I think if you can do those things, you can do a good job, Darren. I mean, I think you could assess what needs to be done, but it's different. Each problem is different. There is no blueprint, if you will, to, mm-hmm. that sort of addresses that in a nutshell. You have to go to the environment and figure it out, because some organizations are learning organizations. Some organizations are just stuck in the past. They're just going to do it the way they do it. They want to do it. And you either conform or you walk. Or you figure out a way. Do you have someone on that staff who's willing to listen to you? Does he have any power in the organization to step up to help out? Or it's sort of like finding who will champion your cause within that organization, because otherwise you have to do it yourself. And if you have to do it yourself, you have to, you know, as I said, dig for it.
Yeah, you remind me, before we jump over to Ayana on this one, you remind me of something I say all the time. UX is about more than just the work. It's about more than prototypes. It's about more than personas. It's about more than all those things. And that becomes the bulk of who we are and how we drive value. They just, everything you just said, that's like, you didn't mention anything about Figma.
Well, the tools are immaterial, man. You're right. The tools are, because you know when you come, you got to let out some tracks, man. And that environment may require just a simple flow chart or something. But you have to be in tuned enough to listen to what they're trying to say. And then how do you move them from where they're currently at to where they want to be? And if you can help. And then sometimes, Darren, the hard part is saying, you know what? I can't do this. Or I don't think I'm the right person to do that for you, because you have other dynamics that are going on that I have no control over. So you tell the truth. You have to be a truth sayer and be honest about who you are, what your skill sets are, and what the environment you're trying to do and what problems you're trying to solve.
Yep. Yep. Awesome. Ayana.
Yes. So this all sounds great. But when you have a client, so I work with more small businesses, right? And you guys work with more corporations. So small businesses, it's usually like 2, 3, 4, 5 people max on the team. There's one decision maker. And, you know, my issues come up with design decisions. And sometimes they want something that's just, you know, these colors do not go together at all. We can look at the color wheel, or this font with all these serifs, it looks hideous. You know, if you look at it, you don't want to use a gradient in your logo. So it's like, I'm coming from my design background and telling them, they think it's my opinion, but it's like, it's through my schooling, through my learning, but they're digging their heels in the ground, even though I'm telling them the truth. So this is another issue that I run into with consulting. That's a really hard thing. I'm telling them the truth. Like, you know, in my professional opinion, it doesn't look that great. And, you know, here's why. But they're like, no, this is what I like. I want to go for it. And so it comes to a point to where it's like, of course, I'm going to continue and working with this client because I need this job. Or do I stop and say, oh, I'm not going to put this in my portfolio. I'm going to stop this job. Need somebody else to do this for you. So there's always that factor too, right?
Right, right. Go ahead. Go ahead, Spencer.
I think the part about consulting is when you run into those walls, I always have like two or three jobs rolling, streaming. I keep my pipeline full for those various occasions. You know, I say, you know what? I just don't think this is going to work out for us. And you leave, right? You go because you don't want to put a bad lick out there. Why? Because you got other things in the pipeline. Remember I tell you about this? You know, Yanni, you and I always had this conversation. keep that pipeline full. And that's the part about consulting that's challenging, right? You have projects that overlap, right? And sometimes you're working for two clients or three clients. If your pipeline is adequately stocked, and that's the other part about being a consultant, you're not only doing work, you're looking for new work. And that's just the way the business is. And until I learned that, that was a trick that solved keeping my lights turned on and to keeping my bank account in the positive and paying off all my bills and creditors and debt, because I kept my pipeline full. Mm-hmm. And in those scenarios, when you have a client that is sort of just not getting it, then don't wait. You know, people say, just don't waste my time. Yeah. You could be tactfully tactful and honest at the same time. Don't waste my time.
Yeah. A couple of things came to mind with what Ayana said for me. One, it was funny as you were describing that, Ayana, I start having flashbacks, and it's funny. I've worked all the way up to Fortune 50, and I've worked for mostly for big corporations, but I've also worked for I've been very fortunate. And most of the companies I worked for, if they weren't a Fortune 1000 company or greater, they were tops in their field. I worked for the top, what do they call it? The autonomous pharmacy company. I don't think they're Fortune 500, but they're number one in their field. I worked for the top retail mortgage company in America. I worked for the top, wholesale mortgage company in America. They weren't Fortune. I think one company is in the Fortune 1,500 now, but the problems that come up, they're actually the same. I was working once, we were redesigning the intranet site for, I believe, a Fortune 50 company. We had the statement of work laid out. Everybody knew what we were going to do. Talk about scope creep. They kept changing things, but basically speaking, I would come back. Okay, this is what we agreed upon. This is what we said we want to do. I got all the information. This is what our starting point from the wireframes. Let's go over this with the stakeholders, and we'll go from here. We'll proceed. We go through three versions of wireframes, and then I think that we're set when we get to version 3, and we're ready to start headed towards development. And, okay, well, let us go get some more stakeholders and see what they think. Long story short, by the time we got to version 48 of the wireframes, no joke, 48 revisions. Do you know that, and after hundreds of stakeholders have come in at every point to give their 2 cents, every time I thought that we had buy-in, they would always go and bring in more stakeholders. I remember being in a meeting once where there had to be at least 100 stakeholders in the room, this gigantic room at this company going over things and giving their 2 cents. We got to version 48 of the wireframes. Do you know that version 48 of the wireframes was almost identical to version 3? Almost identical to version 3. That was a month before I left the company. I'm done. And I pulled the consultant and I moved along. I got on my horse and I rode out of town into the sunset because it's like, and they said that same thing too. Darren, that's your opinion. No, there's a difference between opinion and expert opinion. And everybody has an opinion, but everybody doesn't have an expert opinion. And I had to explain that. And it just became so counterproductive. And I don't even know if they ever even redesigned that intranet. One of the biggest intranet sites in the world, actually. And it just turned into nothing. So I have found, and I did freelance web design, where I was applying UX principles to my work back in the late 90s is when it started. And some of the things that people would do, everywhere you work, somebody's going to come in and say, Google does it like this. And then drop the microphone. And I'm like, Google is not without flaw. You know, Apple does it like this. Oh, you mean the old gray text on the white background that they finally woke up about and changed it back to black because nobody could read the text on the site? And then by the time they changed it, thousands of companies had people come into meetings and say, Apple does it like this, and they changed. And to this day, still have the gray text on the white background because Apple does it like this. People don't understand the difference between expert opinion and opinion. And so, yeah, it just made me think about that. We go through some of the same. So I know you probably already know that your dad prior to it. The battles are the same. The article readers, as I call them, they're the same. They work everywhere. The people that are going to commoditize UX, they're everywhere. And that's why we got to love what we do. I tell people that all the time because there's always somebody somewhere that's going to make you feel like, what in the world am I doing here? And I don't know if you folks saw a post I did recently where we went to a meeting and the stakeholder goes, you know, the users told me that they'd like to do X, Y, and Z. I said, well, you know, we can always test that, but we don't want to just implement it because they said what they like, because users tend to say one thing and do another. Right now, we all know that. You know what this guy said? I've never heard that before. Myself and two other colleagues that were with me started belly laughing because we thought he was kidding. And then by the time our eyes opened, we were laughing so hard, he was sitting there looking at us like, what's so funny? He was dead serious. And we could not do research. We couldn't get approval to do the research because of his attitude. So just funny, the nightmarish stories that come up in UX, but they just keep popping up over and over again. It just made me think about that. So be encouraged. Everybody out there, I ought to be encouraged. They're going to, yeah, but you'd be surprised. Our battles are, they're the same. Be it people, 500 people, 100 people in a room. Everybody got their own agenda as we were talking about the intranet. And so, and they don't even realize that about the bias that's at work in what they're doing and how they're responding. We're here to herd those cats. But they don't respond to us because they don't, you know, and that's UX is always the baby in the room too. Anytime you get that team that comes together, that multidisciplinary team, UX is always the one that nobody understands. We've only been around for so long. And so they feel like they can poo-poo us off. After all, we just come along just to make things look better. Anyway, so it's just funny.
No, it's just everybody's an expert, right? You know that when you walk in the room, right? If you ask a prisoner why you're in jail, I didn't do anything wrong. Well, you know, come on, man. Look at the audience you're asking, right? It's one of those things that, you know, it's true. If you're a criminal who's all his whole life is about crime, and if you ask him, did you do anything wrong? Oh, God, no. Right? And dude, why were you arraigned on this? Why are you arraigned on this? You look at his track sheet. I think, see, you know, corporations, I think, they look for yes people to corroborate what they're saying.
Yeah.
But then you have a few who are in that corporation who understand the relativity truth. And I think one of the things I've now kind of went back and looked at some of Steve Jobs, his old videos, and they're out there. And, you know, he spoke a lot about the truth about users and acknowledging what they do, what they say they want, and they do something different. Mm-hmm. And I've sat through so many usability tests. I've done so many, and I've done usability tests around the world. I mean, India, you know, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Malaysia. And I've seen even cultural things, cultural definitions of stuff, and it's amazing. It's amazing. And users are users. They say one thing, they do something different, right? And I think that's the beauty of what we do. If you understand that, and you just sit there and you go through these meetings, and sometimes it's, you know, I listen to the noise or the radio volume, right? You got, and you're right, they'll give you like 40, 50 different renditions of it. And then finally you just say, I'm either going to hang in here long enough, or you look at your watch, you start looking down at your watch when we were doing face-to-face meetings, and let them know that, you know, you're either, and I'm like, I go, are you bored now? I go, well, I'm getting there. You know, I'm getting to the point where you guys don't get it. You know, and they're like, well, we're paying you. I said, I know you're paying me. I said, but I said, now we're wasting money. I said, because we're running from the truth and you're trying to make something that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And no matter how I tell it or rephrase it or show you the results. But I think the beauty is if you've done the usability testing, you can run the tapes back, right? You can run those, clips through their evaluation. That's the only leverage you have. But if you don't have that type of ammunition, and that's why I said you have to do your research when these guys start coming out of the woodworks on you. You have to have some, as I said, I hate to use the word Trump, but you have that card in your back pocket and go, you pull it out and go, you know what? You want to play this card because here's the reasons why you want to play this particular card.
Yeah.
Right. So it's being able to have something in your back pocket to play it at the right, the appropriate time.
Absolutely. And you touched on the next topic. So we're going to pick on that and go there. The dangers of placating as a UX professional. You were talking about this during the warm up. So let's go back to that. You just touched on it there a moment. So let's go back there.
You know, that whole notion of when you introduce yourself and the crowd kind of goes, he's the guy, you know, like when they introduce the player on the football thing, you know, when he comes in, they're going to score a touchdown. Or who's the guy from Ghost State Warriors, Yanni, who every time he hits his hand, he's hitting threes all the time? Steph.
Oh, Steph Curry.
When Steph gets the ball, you know, he's going to knock down on three, man. He'll dump it. He'll jump in two. He go, no, I'm gonna do this three on you, right? And I think when you placate people, I think you have to, or you're in that thing and you're using that type of, shall we say, leverage. You have better know what you're doing and who the audience that you're working with, because that can come back and haunt you, man. Because you put it out there, and you know, people Google stuff, right? This is a flavor, right? You know, I Google, right? Okay, you know, you hear that all the time. People take those phrases. I mean, hey, one guy, he was writing down everything I said. I'm like, are you serious? I wrote down everything you said in that meeting. And I went and I did this. And you're like, oh my God. So you know the audience. You got to know your audience. But at the same time, you have to be careful about how you establish your priorities and what you're going to use as your milestones and your go-tos to move that conversation along. Because when you start placating people, it's sort of like the aha moment. And you know, people at meetings, they go, uh-huh, and their head nod, right? Uh-huh, uh-huh. And then you're in a sense, you're placating because you may or may not know what that person is talking about, but you're sort of fencing to make yourself feel good to fit in that conversation, right? And so you say things that you probably wouldn't normally say. So I always have to catch myself too sometimes, because we're humans, right? We're humans, right? We live in the real world, and the real world says, you know, sometimes you just gotta bluster a little bit here because I want to make myself. And I remember doing that in my earlier part of my career. I'm not gonna lie, because I had to go, okay, you're either short on knowledge or time, or you just didn't know. Right before you really learn to say, there are no dumb questions, and you can raise your hand to say, you know, I didn't get that, right? And you know, and I think the smart people will ask that question, because those are the ones in the audience that you better watch out, because they're going to ask those dumb questions, because you know that person, he's not asking that question because he doesn't know. He's asking you either to repeat yourself, to either find out whether you understand what you really think you know or what you don't know. Or is that really the course? Because we all too often look at user experience as the you representing user experience as the go-to person who knows everything. And quite often, sometimes I don't know users all that well, right? You know, I don't have all the empirical data, right? You know, it's like, you know, my wife is a data scientist, right? So sometimes this company in San Francisco, for example, here again, you know, they asked me to design this interaction on a virtual whiteboard, But what they wanted to do is they wanted to capture all the people who were in the brainstorming session to evaluate their what I call the numbers, all the roll-ups. What does the curve look like when you have all these different people voicing opinions, and how many dots do they get to place? Because it's sort of like, you know, when you're doing the Xfinity diagrams, or you group things, right? Now you got all these groups. Okay, now we got to put dots on those groups, right? You know, what business goals really resonate the most with you guys in this room, because they're all managers or whomever they are. So they got to put dots on them, right? And you say, okay, everybody get 3 dots. You can either sign them all in one part card, or you can spread them across, or you give them 5, whatever the number is. So what we were doing in San Francisco was trying to resonate this stuff. But at the same time, when I was trying to get them to understand, you know, because I had to go get some more research, and I said, you know, I said, hey, how do we do this and map this stuff back to a visual diagram? Because visuals help illustrate the story, but then if you don't have those visuals, and you start propping people up with using just terms to make them feel good, or you're using things that you probably don't know all that well, you're lying to the audience. And then, as I said, people can Google, right? So that position you were holding, you know, was a false position, right? You know, it's a house of cards, right? And someone will come along and kick those. So I just, you know, I learned early on in my career that you just got to talk facts to facts. If you don't know something, you don't know it. And you just say, you know what, I don't know it, but tomorrow I'll have an answer for you, or I'll get an answer for you, because I think I have some friends who are in this building, just do my due diligence. But that's your job, isn't it? Yep. As a UX designer, to do your job, right? You have to research not only within the confines of what you do, but to ask questions of other individuals.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ayanna, was your hand up? Okay, I missed you. Okay, make sure I don't miss you. We are running short on time, so I'm going to skip one topic, but let's reconvene to talk about UX hiring another time. But we're going to move to our closing topic. And I'm sure both of you have something on this one. How do you view the current trajectory of UX as a discipline? What do you see is happening in UX? What direction are we headed? What's good? What's bad? What do you see? You want to start this one off, Ayanna?
Yeah, I'll start it off. I'll keep my answer a little bit more concise. But it's because, you know, I'm kind of in the budding ground. I work with learners who are 16 to 25 years old, and they're learning how to code. They're learning these languages. They're learning about, like, what they want to do and what products they would create for the world. So they're experiencing social media firsthand before our generation, your generation has. And so it's interesting. I'm really hopeful that this trajectory of user experience and design has a little bit more, I want to say, like, compassion, a moral compass, even with the data collection as well, and just has more of a interactive approach, because all of these tools that they've been using for creating content have been so dynamic, right? So there was, like, and I'm going to talk about social media tools like Vine. You created a 6-second video, and then, you know, corporations caught on to it and they wanted to have advertising. And so it was easy to create content that way. And then TikTok came out after, you know, years later, and you can create longer videos. And so I think just from that standpoint, and the users that are using it from this generation, this young generation, that it's just going to be a little bit more dynamic and just easier to create different types of multimedia that's coming out right now.
Awesome. Awesome. And folks need to consider those things too. I'm entering TikTok, by the way.
I can't wait to see what you come up with.
I saw a lot of garbage out there. Well, we're going to go and clean up the water a little bit. I haven't produced anything since I did my intro, but it's coming. It's coming.
TikTok. Let me tell you one thing about TikTok. It's becoming the second most searchable tool next to Google.
Heard that.
People are going to TikTok to learn how to do things more than Google now.
That's almost amazing. More than Google. That's amazing. I actually just started rolling out this week what I call a UX skills inventory. And I think that may be what I start doing and just start rolling out, producing these little 2-minute videos that talk about UX skills and how you do an inventory to really take charge of that self-examination, that self-awareness component of where you are, and then the steps you need to take in order to build that part of your UX acumen.
And I think these young users are going to take that and create niche products that speak to us or them or whoever they're creating for, because they know who they are on the inside and know how to create products that will speak to them and that are adapted to that group.
That's a really nice evolutionary aspect of that. The way it is. Hopefully I get to observe it and understand what I'm seeing, but based on what you just described, we can see that. But I like the way I like how that sounds. And I like the innovation, so to speak, that comes into play with that people can see something and recognize, how does this grow? What does this transition to? What does it translate into? And then go ahead and take it to that next level or the next 2 or 3 or 4 levels. So that's fantastic. Love to hear that. I see that look on Spencer's face. He's ready. What do you see, sir?
No. I listened to my daughter talk about these avenues into design, and as part of the discussion I had yesterday with this manager, should I take a step further with her, or get involved with them, is some of that, right? And I think where the evolution of design is going, and they keep talking about, well, AI is going to design everything. Like, okay, AI is going to either interpret what we say and kind of like translate it. I know when I was working in artificial intelligence for NASA Ames, I was a knowledge engineer, and we were crash chips. At the time, Texas Instruments was building the fastest processor. I'd write code, and the machine would run like 2 or 3 days trying to human interaction, how humans do things. It's just like a complexity of rules.
Yes.
But we fire off this stuff in our head like it's just automatically, as we say, automatically. And then you try to write it in a language so the computer could do it. I don't see it happening, because processing power is, it's jumping leapfrogs. But human reasoning is a hard thing.
Yeah.
Right? And, computers it's like a fourth, a 4-year-old? Is it? I think that they're up to the level of a 4-year-old. And I don't think they're ever going to get past that, because there's so much duplicity of meaning of words that we use to describe things that you'd have to write a dictionary on a couple words, because they could be used in so many different ways. So now you got TikTok, right? It's eclipsing, the YouTube videos, right? And, it's just sort of like unrehearsed, kind of like off the cuff. Oh, this is me. This is all about me. This is how I do stuff. You're like, really? Do I really care? First of all, I would say, do I really care? I always ask myself, do I really care? No, I don't. Because I'm not, say, stuck in my ways. It's sort of like I'm sharing. Those people are sharing who they are. So it's the messaging that we're the next curve of UX is going. How do I get my message out there to other people to get them embraced and engaged? It's sort of like this Bitcoin collapse, right? I don't know how much Bitcoin you bought or how deep you were involved.
Zero.
Yeah, it's the same for me, because I kept saying unregulated. And, we're playing stock markets. You still get shook out, right? You know, we got a regulated market. You can still lose everything. And we're playing, talking about unregulation. It's like, what the hell are people thinking? You're putting what kind of money in an unregulated market? So I think the whole thing is the messaging, because they took the messaging of Bitcoin, they phrased it, oh, you're going to get rich. And I had people like sending me emails, oh, you're so stupid. You're stuck in your ways. I said, no. I said, because I'm looking at the rules of engagement. Your message is telling me I should be ruthless and crazy. I've lost enough money. I was in the dot-com boom, right? I had stock options. And, you know, I was on paper financially set for the rest of my life, right? I leveraged against those options because I thought that I could go, I want to be a million. I want to be a billionaire. And then I woke up one day, the market had collapsed. So the reality, see, this is the whole reality. So it's the messaging. So when you bring this all back, it's the messaging where that next evolution of UX is going, because people seem to believe that is the thing that you want to do. I see it as ease of use, and we kind of overuse the word ease of use. We're moving past having to fill out forms to do things in an economical way is where I think user experience can pay back people. But as far as TikTok is concerned, you know, it's a flash in the pan, right? It's the hot thing. You know, the guy, what did he do? He had some juice drink and he hit like what was the one where some dude was riding his bicycle or his motor scooter doing the juice thing, and he like
cranberry juice.
Yeah, the cranberry juice dude. And he crushed it.
Skateboard. Yeah.
But see, Darren, that just tells me the simplicity of our society has gotten to the point where simple is too damn simple, right? And it, to me, it's like, well, I'm sorry. I'm just not going there, right? And it's about the messaging, the tool. I'm more about making human beings more integrated with technology without technology taking over their life and being pervasive and doing them injustice. I'm more about just the mundane things without having to always have to repetitiously do things. The simple things should be simple. The hard things should become simpler to do. That's where I go. That's what I'm thinking. And there's still a lot of hard problems to be solved out there, right? Mm-hmm. But we just sort of like fashionably gone TikTok-ish, right? Or we're Twittered out, right? Or Elon, we're Musk out. Elon's buying the company or he's not buying the company. And he's a dick, by the way, right? Because he's never lined up on the right. He's never lined up behind the arrows behind one topic or another, but the guy's like all over the map. Or he's having kids by all these other women. I'm like, dude, what is he doing? Because he's got money and power. And this leads into the problem of our society. I'm going to close with this because it just nags at me. It seems that people with the money are driving the curve, right? And now they've gotten themselves down. They wanted to change the lie. If you didn't win, you didn't win. if the votes didn't add up for your favor, then you just take the back seat, go sit down someplace, man, and run again. Don't try to sell a lie and make everybody believe it. It's so, you know, that's the messaging, right?
Yeah.
That messaging. We have to be careful how we message and use that user experience of messaging to convince other people about things that are potentially harmful. And there are people with master's degrees who believe that lie. And I just, you know, I'm sad.
PhD,
and I'm sorry that I thought 1 + 1 was always 2.
Always 2. Yep. I say the same thing.
You can't imagine things happening and then say, well, no, I think I won. So therefore I won. And, you know, and it's just, I don't know, where are we going? That's the user experience, right? We're telling each other lies and believing them. And I think, and Diana, I told you this too, that whole social media stuff, it's kind of fringe edge and it's out of control because
anybody can
do a platform, and if you get people to lie enough, they start believing that stuff. So
off the charts.
I'm gonna try to, and I'm away from it, but we gotta control the messaging. Let's solve the problems that we can solve that produces tangible results for humanity.
Yes.
Not just a buzzword. Not buzzwords. I'm sorry. The grapefruit juice guy, what was he riding? What was it?
Riding a motorcycle. And it's so, I mean, there's just, I was just saying, like, TikTok has been inspirational platform for all of these people, right? And that then there would be more niche products for people to create these like social interactivities.
Yeah, all right. I'll leave it at that. You know, I'll leave you with the last thing. You know, Dad. You know, Dad's old school and how I feel about social media. Right, social media got us into this mess a long time ago, and that was back when Facebook did its thing. But anyway, sorry, Darren.
Okay, everybody. I think that's a great place to stop for today. Join us again next week as we share the conclusion of this three-part series. We hope you heard something that stirs you up, something that helps you along on your UX journey, something that gives you some food for thought that furthers you along your way. So that's all the time we have for today, though. So until next week, this is Darren Hood, the host of The World of UX, signing off. Happy UXing, everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this session of CX of M Radio. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, and visit cxofm.org for more resources.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.